This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday, October 18th, 2025. Today, it gives me great pleasure to have as our guest and bring back Dr. Tanya Bilcik. In the waning weeks of our show, I really wanted to get her back on. She was one of our original guests 16 years ago when she was at the Hartford Headache Center that she founded. She's now at Yale Medicine. And we've had several questions come in over the past several weeks regarding headaches. So we are going to get to those questions for her later in the show. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about things going on in the news. As many of you know, the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine was awarded last week. And it was awarded to three scientists for their work on the immune system. They are immunologists. And when we think of the immune system, it's the system that attacks germs that are not part of our bodies. Now, it also works on autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. It is the hallmark of vaccination, altering or more accurately boosting the immune system in some way to fight disease and even some types of cancer. So I find it very interesting that their work on regulatory T cells was awarded the Nobel Prize as we are struggling with so much going on in the news today regarding immunology and regarding vaccination. Just this past week, in South Carolina, Spartanburg, South Carolina, hundreds of students were quarantined because of 12 confirmed cases of measles. Measles, something we got rid of in the 1990s. These were contracted in two schools and a fitness center. Now, 90% of the people in Spartanburg County have been vaccinated against measles. But we know that the figure for herd immunity is 95%. You need to get to 95% to get herd immunity. Fortunately, here in Connecticut, we are at 98%. But 67% of the entire United States is below that 95%. So we're going to see more of these. In fact, we are. We're seeing them in Ohio, Minnesota. So we need to get on this and promote, better vaccination rates. And we need to protect cancer patients, children who can't get vaccinated. They have rights to go to school. So the one thing we all were upset about, quarantine, right, during COVID, now we're quarantining students. They have to stay home. So something's not working. And I bring this up because the president this past week came out with a very interesting quote at his press conference. I'm going to read it exactly. The MMR, I think, should be taken separately. This is based on what I feel. What I feel. This is how we're creating health policy in the United States. Now, it is interesting when he does these press conferences, right, that they have to fill in the background with nodding heads. And it's usually Mehmet Oz. Dr. Oz, right, a highly regarded cardiac surgeon who literally had people's hearts in his hands to repair, is now standing behind the president who's coming out with what can only be classified as idiocy, and he's shaking his head like some stooge. it's embarrassing as a physician to even look at that. But let's move on. Okay, the president says what he feels. But now the CDC, the acting CDC director, a guy named Jim O'Neill, here's a man, okay, in a very powerful position for the Centers for Disease Control who has absolutely no medical background. He's an investor. And he has tight political ties to a guy named Peter Thiel, another political supporter. This is what we are dealing with right now. But, you know, let's take a look back at the science of the MMR vaccine. All this controversy came out in 1998 when a discredited physician by the name of Andrew Wakefield in England published in The Lancet a bogus article. And he's no longer a physician because of that. And in that he said the MMR vaccine causes autism, which it does not. We have proven that time and again. We have been using the MMR vaccine by history since 1971. And in some cases, the MMR vaccine is used in combination with the varicella vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine. And the importance of that is to avoid shingles, right? We know that the chickenpox, the varicella virus, is what causes shingles that many of us get later in life if we don't get the vaccine. So suddenly, the president has a feeling we should separate these. And actually, he said, we're giving children a full pint of vaccination liquid, which is, again, idiocy. But, and in fact, separating the vaccines, in 2009, the CDC recommended separating the MMR and varicella vaccine in children under the age of four. So the first shots they get are at age 14 months. At that injection, it's MMR only. Varicella is then given separately at a different time. They are all given together after age 5. And the reason they gave for separating varicella was an increased risk of febrile seizures. So what they're proposing now is something we've been doing since 2009. But let's get back to separating the MMR vaccine. So MMR is a polyvalent vaccine, meaning it has multiple, it has multiple effects. It's three vaccines in one. What they are proposing now is separating that into three separate monovalent vaccines. So this would mean giving injections three times instead of one time. Now, one of the big problems is there are no monovalent MMR vaccines. There isn't a monovalent measles. There isn't a monovalent mumps. There isn't a monovalent rubella vaccines available in the United States today. Not there. So it would mean going back and getting FDA approval for a drug company to get three different vaccines approved. This is hard to do. It's hard to do because vaccines are something we give to healthy people. We don't give it to people who are sick. So the rules are so stringent for that approval because you don't want to make someone who's healthy sick. And you cannot, they're saying we want controlled studies. Again, impossible to do. What are you going to do? In a controlled study, that means you'd have to take a group of children and say, we're not giving them vaccines, leaving them susceptible to all these diseases. Can't do that. That is unethical. So we have to go based on what we knew before we had the vaccine, which we have a lot of history of, before 1971. And since 1971. And that has proven time and again that this is effective. But let's go back to the practicality of it. So we've already discussed there's no science behind it. Practically, there are no monovalent vaccines available. But now let's just think about it. Any parent that's brought their child for their shots, for lack of a better term, This is a stressful situation. Bad enough that we're giving them one shot with three vaccines. Now we're going to repeat this two more times. So there's an inconvenience. There's some pain. Now a parent will have to take time off from work to go to the doctor, all right, three more times, all right, three times instead of one. So two more times. So there's that inconvenience. There's the cost, right? The insurance company's going to pay or the patient's going to pay for each visit for those shots. Provider time. Doctors, nurses are all busy. APRN, whoever you're seeing as your primary care provider is busy and doesn't have a lot of time to now separate something that could be given more efficiently. And you have to deal with storage for these things. So there are so many problems with this feeling that our president has from a period of science and the fellow who's backing him, the investor who is now in charge. We're going to keep an eye on this because we're going to be hearing more and more about measles because it's spreading. Why measles and not others? Because it is so virulent. You're spreading the disease before you know you even have it. That's the problem. This day in medicine, October 18, 1871, Dr. Charles Babbage died. Dr. Babbage was an English mathematician, and he constructed the first ophthalmoscope. Now, that's that device that your doctor uses to look into your eye and see the retina in the back of your eye. In that, he also, as a mathematician, he devised the basic principles of modern computers. So imagine this. He died in 1870. So before 1871, he devised the language and the principles for modern computers. He computed the first reliable actuarial tables, those tables that say, based on someone's health, how long they're going to live, that insurance companies use all the time. He designed the first modern postal system, and he constructed the first speedometer, all in the 1800s, that 19th century. So we really salute Dr. Charles Babbage today, and with that, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Tanya Bilczyk, and with Dr. Bilczyk, we're discussing headaches. So if you need to reach out to me, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com, and I will be getting to the questions that have been proposed already by John, Terry, and Claire during the course of our conversation. If you have more questions, just reach out to me. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, and it's great to present my guest today, Dr. Tanya Bilczyk. As many of you know, Dr. Bilczyk has been a frequent guest on our program since its inception 16 years ago. Back then, she was the founder and director of the Hartford Headache Center, and she did that for 15 years. Now she is part of Yale Medicine. She is a board-certified neurologist specializing in headache. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Good. Thank you for having me again. This is an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Well, let's talk. Let's regroup and kind of talk a little bit about headaches because it's such a huge problem in this country. It has so much impact not only on people's social lives but the productivity of the country. So can you talk to us a little bit about headaches in general and the types of headaches that are most common?
Absolutely. I think the most common headache that pretty much everybody gets is something called a tension headache, which is a mild to moderate headache, pretty common, but generally does not cause significant disability. The tension headache is generally a generalized headache felt in the front of the head. It doesn't really have these associated symptoms that we attribute to migraines. So if you have a tension headache, you generally don't have nausea, light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, or movement sensitivity. They can be self-limiting. They usually go away with rest, hydration, or over-the-counter medications. So Tension headaches are the most common headaches, but it's not the headache type that generally brings you to seek medical attention. The commonest headache that we see is migraine, and that's not an uncommon headache disorder. 1 in 5 women between the ages of 15 and 60 have migraine. That's 20% of the population in childbearing ages, and so it's a very common and pretty disabling condition because a migraine headache is a moderately severe headache with light sensitivity, with noise sensitivity, with movement sensitivity, and with nausea. And when people have migraine, they often have a very hard time functioning. So I'd say that even though the tension headache is more common in a headache practice or even in a general neurology practice or even in a primary care practice, the most common complaint is related to migraine. So that's kind of the most common headache types we have. And then we've got some pretty unusual headache types that are less frequent but often pretty disabling as well.
Tanya, I have a question that came up from Margaret, and this is probably the best time to do it because you're talking about tension headache. But the question was, can you ask Dr. Bilczyk about the role of yoga and non-medicinal approaches to headache, and I guess specifically tension headache, since you're talking about that and being common. Is there a role for those things either in conjunction with medicine or independent of taking medication?
Absolutely. I think that exercise is a wonderful, wonderful headache preventive of all kinds of headaches. I think yoga, which improves your neck mobility and general stretching, is really helpful. There is not a lot of data on acupuncture or alternatives, but I've got patients that think that getting acupuncture regularly, there are a lot of alternatives that I think are helpful. Biofeedback, relaxation, stress management, yoga, yoga breathing, exercise, stretching, regular cardiovascular exercise. I think that is hugely helpful. And there actually are studies that show that exercising on a regular basis is as good as taking a regular medication. So yes, very helpful. Yoga,
great.
Why not? Especially if you've got tight neck muscles. Relaxation, massage, all of the things that can take some of the stress and tension out of your life, because the commonest cause of both tension headaches and migraine headaches is stress. And God knows we've got enough of that at the moment.
Yeah, that's for sure. We have a couple of minutes before the break, but can you talk a little bit, you mentioned about the neck muscles. Can you talk about the importance of neck muscles and tightness of neck muscles in headache in general?
Absolutely. So the musculoskeletal system is kind of the neck, the trapezius muscle is part of your musculoskeletal system. The trapezius muscle is the muscles that attach to the back of the head. There's a little ridge at the back of your head, and that's where the trapezius muscles attach, and they also attach to the shoulder blades and to the shoulder. So trapezius muscles tend to get very tight in people that do a lot of typing and a lot of sitting and a lot of computer work. That the trapezius attaches to the back of the head, the radiating point from those trapezius muscles from the posterior part of the head is actually to the temples. And the physical therapists know this really well because they call them the trigger point sites from the trapezius muscle radiating to the temple and even to the front part of the head, because the next place that the muscles attach from, you know, the back of your head where your trapezius attaches along the area, we call it the nuchal ridge, the back of the head, is actually just above the eyebrows, the front. So that's the next place the muscles attach. So if those muscles get tight, there are a lot of referral patterns to the front, to above the eyebrows. So when you get that kind of squeezing, tight pressure, headband, tight hat feeling, that's kind of often what we call referred pain from the trapezius muscles.
Great. We're going to take a short break. And Michael, we're going to get to your question about cervical fusion and headaches right after the break. We're going to take a short break. My guest today is Dr. Tanya Bilczyk. We're talking about headaches, and we're going to get into the treatment of headaches, and we're going to get to a lot of the questions that have come in. By way of referral, if you wish to contact Dr. Bilczyk, her office number is 203-785 1-800-430-4085. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And today it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest, Dr. Tanya Bilchik, and we're talking about headaches. And right before the break, Michael reached out to me with the question that I have had a cervical fusion performed, and ever since then, I have had headaches. This seems to be a common problem in people who have had cervical procedures. I know in my practice I see them. Tanya, what could we offer Michael?
Well, here's the kind of the thing. I always, when I get a new patient with headache symptoms, I always refer to something called the International Headache Society Classification of Headache Disorders. And headaches that come from the cervical spine are called cervicogenic headaches. And the cervicogenic headaches can stem, obviously, from either irritated nerve roots in the cervical spine. So if you've had cervical surgery, those nerve roots could have been irritated. Also, the muscles. We talked a little bit earlier about tension-type headache, but the trapezius muscles attached to the back of the head, they also have innervation from the nerves in the neck. And so sometimes you have what we call a kind of a myofascial type headache secondary to kind of post-neck surgery and stuff like that. So the pain sources in neck can either come from the muscles or the joints or the nerves as they come out. And so we can even talk about what we call a headache attributed to cervical myofascial pain. So as the neck is, you know, I would say the neck is connected to the head, the muscles are connected to the back of the head, and so it's not uncommon to have either pre- or post-surgical head pain. And one of the things I recommend is physical therapy, heat, ice, kind of real basics. And then occasionally, if the things don't improve, I refer my patients to physiatrist, physical medicine and rehab for either trigger point injections or maybe nerve blocks. But I would probably start with physical therapy and kind of myofascial release type stuff.
Great. I hope that helps you there, Michael. Let's talk a little bit about migraine headaches, the types of migraine headaches. You talked about the international classification, and that changes pretty readily, and it actually gets more simplified, I think. But can you talk a little bit about the types of migraine headaches and how we classify them?
Oh, so we first talk about what is a migraine. So most people, probably, you know, I'd say 80% of people with migraine, maybe kind of a little less than that, have what we call migraine without aura. In other words, there are no visual changes. So sometimes people don't recognize that those are actually migraine, because what are the cardinal features of migraine? Is a moderately severe headache. It can be one side, it can be both sides, often throbbing, but the cardinal features are light sensitivity and noise sensitivity and or nausea. And in adults, the duration of migraine is 4 to 72 hours. In kids, they can be shorter. I think most people recognize migraine with aura. In other words, the visual changes associated with migraine, which usually occur before migraine, and they think of those as, we call them, they used to be called classical migraine. Now we call them migraine with aura, and the aura can last from 15 minutes to 60 minutes, often preceding the headache, but can occur during the headache. And, you know, we also talk about migraine with aura in women as being a slightly higher stroke risk, because I know that's something you wanted to talk to me about.
Yes.
We can also have migraine aura without headache. And often as people get older with a history of migraine, they may have the migraine aura without the headache. So you can have all variations, migraine with aura, migraine without aura, and migraine aura without headache. Those are all parts of migraine. Then, not only do we have episodic migraine, but we also have something called chronic migraine. And the definition of chronic migraine is somebody who has 15 or more headache days per month. They don't all have to be migraine. At least 8 of them need to fit the criteria for migraine, or somebody's taken migraine or some kind of medication on at least 8 of those days. So chronic migraine seems to be more prevalent in headache clinics, more disabling and, you know, not uncommon, and more headache days than not with people that miss lots of work because of them.
When you talk about people who only experience the aura, does that fit into that category where we hear ocular migraines or people who come in and say, I have ocular migraine?
Yes, then I always kind of go, that's a very old-fashioned term because, again, we're going back to the International Headache Society classification of, you know, much more recent. I think it's on its third iteration. And, yeah, that was what we used to call the ocular migraine, but it's migraine without migraine or without headache.
So getting back to John's question, are patients with migraine in general more susceptibility to having a stroke?
Migraine with aura. The data is migraine with aura in women. That's where most of the data comes from. And there are kind of theories about why they're, you know, they know that migraine with aura may be associated with something that's also associated with stroke, and that's a patent foramen ovale, which is a connection between the left and the right atria of the heart. So that in itself, so the migraine with aura is a stroke risk, but the best data really comes from women. So I always look at women with migraine with aura as a slightly higher stroke risk, particularly if they have other stroke risks. I don't think migraine is as big a stroke risk as things like hypertension, diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, obesity, etc. So the data comes mostly with women with migraine with aura. And this is a question I get asked a lot because women want to be on hormone replacement or estrogen-containing contraceptives.
Right.
And the World Health Organization and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has come up with a position statement saying that estrogen-containing oral contraceptives are contraindicated in women with migraine with aura. So that's kind of interesting because some of the neurologists and headache specialists may not always agree with that, but we're going to follow the party line and say no estrogen-containing oral contraceptives in women with migraine with aura.
Should those people, should that population also consider a baby aspirin daily as prophylaxis?
We don't recommend it, not at this. There's no data on that yet.
Okay.
If other stroke risks, then that would kind of preclude that.
All right. Let's, well, another listener question was about vestibular migraine. Can you talk a little bit about vestibular migraine and the treatment and symptoms?
So let's first work out what the definition of vestibular migraine is, because all sorts of dizziness is more common
right.
in people with migraine. So I will often get a consult, this patient has dizziness, and I'm going, but where's the history of migraine? If there's dizziness without a history of migraine, I would never call it vestibular migraine. However, if somebody has a history, so again, we go back to our International Headache Society classification of headache disorders. It makes life easy for us. If you have a history of migraine and at least 50% of the time you have episodes of vertigo associated with migraine, that's probably vestibular migraine. So you can have episodes of vertigo without migraine as well, but you do have a history of migraine. So the first thing that I use when I diagnose somebody with vestibular migraine is, do they have a history of migraine? Because there are other things that are also more, other dizzy conditions that are much more common in people with migraine as well. There's something called BPPV, benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. PPPD, persistent positional postural dizziness. All of these other dizzy conditions, even Meniere's disease, which is another kind of ENT vestibulopathy, vestibular problem, are more common in people with migraines. So if you have a history of migraine and you have vertigo with your migraine attacks, I would call that vestibular migraine, and those patients can also have dizziness without a migraine attack, but they do need to have a history of migraine to call it vestibular migraine.
Okay, and you got to my question, which was, would you still call it that if you did not get the headache portion of it, and just it, even with a history of migraine headache?
Yes, you can. You can have episodes of vertigo
perfect.
Without headache as long as you have a history of migraine as well. But I will get referrals for somebody who just has dizziness, no history of migraine, no history of headache, and I get the referral rule out vestibular migraine, and it just doesn't fit. Again, we go back to our International Headache Society classification, and I use that as my gold standard. If you fit, you fit.
How would you treat vestibular migraine? Would you attack the vestibular portion of it or just go right to the heart of it and treat the migraine?
Both. I mean, I treat, you know, if it's vestibular migraine, you know, with migraine, you, depending on the frequency, you treat with prevention and you treat with acute treatment. So often with vestibular symptoms, with migraine, then the vestibular symptoms may be more prominent, we use migraine preventives. We use a lot of the same things we use in migraine prevention, the older meds, the tricyclic antidepressants, amitriptyline, nortriptyline, some of the newer antidepressants, venlafaxine, which is the trade name for Effexor. We use some of the antihypertensives, maybe verapamil. You know, I've even got patients whose vestibular or vertigo symptoms improve when we put them on the newer migraine medications, which blocks a neuropeptide called CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide. So I think you just treat it like migraine.
Okay. Let's go back. Let's take a step back. We're getting ahead of ourselves. And I wanted to talk quite a bit about the development of effective medications. Now, you and I certainly remember the days of ergotamines, right? Ergotamine was what you used. Ergostat, we used ergot suppositories. I mean, and even before that, barbiterates, right, were the
treatment. Remember Cafagot and Furoset and all of those meds? So fortunately, and, you know, again, this is history going back to the early 90s, the triptans came out, and they were the first group of migraine-specific medications that were actually invented to block some of the migraine pathophysiology or the chemicals. So we had in the 90s and 2000s, you know, seven triptans in various combinations, nasal spray, tablets, injectable, et cetera. And so I think that changed things a lot from kind of mid-90s to 2016, 2017. However, with the triptans, they also are known to cause vasoconstriction. They cause blood vessels to narrow. And so people that have vascular risk factors, they're getting back to our people with potential stroke or heart disease or heart attack, those weren't always kind of the ideal medication. So we looked for alternatives. And, you know, what did we have? We had something called Furoset, butalbital, with a combination of caffeine and acetaminophen or aspirin and caffeine. The butalbital compounds, unfortunately, are pretty addictive, and so we don't use them. We really don't like using them very much.
We still see them.
I mean,
I still see people coming in. They went to the emergency room and they gave them a script for Furoset.
Yeah, you know why? It's kind of easy. It's cheap. The problem is it has potential addiction. I always said I never say never because I still have patients that have been on this group of medications since the 90s. They've done well. They haven't escalated their use. The dog hasn't eaten it. It hasn't fallen in the toilet and hasn't been stolen out of the car. I remember those days. I don't know if you do.
I do.
The dog ate it.
So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Somebody comes in on Furoset, it's working, they haven't abused it.
Right.
And you know, I do the same. Right.
I'm very frugal. It's like, okay, you can have 10 to 15 tablets a month. That's it.
So,
and we don't want to escalate the use of these medications. It's like opiates. I don't use opiates in headache ever. Ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's and I think most physicians have caught on to that. I rarely see people coming in on opiates.
And often they're on opiates for another reason. And I think being on opiates actually makes it very much more difficult to kind of manage migraines. Even other patients that are on chronic opiates for back problems or, you know, other orthopedic or musculoskeletal issues. And they're much harder to treat with migraine medications. It's almost like the opiates have kind of made it, lowered the headache threshold.
Let's go to the triptans. I mean, there's, you mentioned the variety of triptans, nasal spray, you know, under the tongue. What's your go-to triptan?
My go-to is either two of the oldest generics now are rizatriptan and sumatriptan. And those are my go-to because they are mostly well-tolerated. If effective 60 to 75% of the time and not outrageously expensive. And generally, I'd say that roughly two-thirds of my migraine patients do just fine on triptans. We also start with triptans because they're generic, they're reasonable, as long as they're not contraindications, as I said, like vascular disease or even severe Raynaud's, we go with the triptans. And they work. The problem is they work great, but they have a few more side effects than some of our newer acute migraine medications that don't cause vasoconstriction and don't cause all of those side effects. And we've had what we call Gepant, G-E-P-A-N-T. They've been available for more than 5 years now. And they seem to be well-tolerated, and the data shows that they're not quite as effective as triptans, but they work really well. And in some people, it's like, this is the best thing they've ever had. I think no side effects is really important.
So then we get into the CGRP antagonists, and now there's such a variety of those.
Absolutely.
Again, what's your go-to of those?
Okay, are we talking about the injectables or the orals? I would say with the injectables, it's whichever, you know, nobody's done a head-to-head study of the three. Actually, they're now four. Nobody's done a head-to-head study on erenumab versus fremanezumab versus galcanezumab versus eptinezumab. I literally will start with whichever one is co-preferred on the insurance.
We better go with brand names because I can't remember all the mabs either, so.
Okay, so we've got Ajovy, we've got Aimovig, and we've got Emgality. Those are our kind of three common once-a-month injectables. And it really does depend on what the insurance company is kind of likely to cover first.
Okay.
That's fortunately because there's no head-to-head study. The only thing I would add is Aimovig has more constipation than the other two.
Okay.
And then we also have an oral version of a CGRP blocking medication. It's a tablet taken once a day. Its generic name is Atogepant. It's also known as Qualipta. It's a daily pill versus a monthly injectable, and it has a similar mechanism of action. It does block the CGRP receptor. And again, side effects-wise, a little more kind of stomachy, irritability, but kind of, again, pretty well tolerated. These meds have changed my practice. It really has.
Sure.
I mean, I now have seen patients that have been on them for 5-6 years. They do great. And, you know, their migraine frequency has improved. The intensity has decreased. Their use of acute medications has improved. And, you know, it's really changed migraine practice, which is wonderful as a headache doctor.
Do you use Qulipta? So, again, we have Qulipta, right? We have Nurtec. We had Ubrelvy, right? These are all oral.
So both, if we go into the prevention world, we talk about Qulipta daily as a migraine preventive. And then, interestingly, Nurtec, which is Rimagepant, is a kind of an interesting mix because it's being used for acute migraine. And if you take it every other day, it's shown benefit in migraine prevention. So it's kind of an interesting concept of taking something every other day for migraine prevention. It's not always easy to remember to take something every other day. That's my only criticism, but the medication is very well tolerated. And it's shown efficacy as well. So I think we've got choices here, which is wonderful. And, you know, there's new stuff coming out all the time.
Is this another choice that's insurance-driven with Qulipta, Nurtec, Ubrelvy?
Less so. Sometimes it's with, you know, if we're talking about acute treatment, because Ubrelvy and Nurtec are both approved for acute migraine, depending on which one of them is often more preferred on one insurance carrier than the other. So that's what I will go with.
When we talk about prevention, you already mentioned going with the tricyclics. Do you still use beta blockers in people?
The American Headache Society has actually come up with a position statement recently that says we should start out treating our patients with the best prevention. So if we really think of what's the best prevention, we're actually saying the CGRPs should be
first.
However, I still use beta blockers, absolutely. you know, little propranolol, an old-fashioned beta blocker, has got good data on migraine prevention. It helps, you know, blood pressure, and it also helps anxiety. So if you've kind of got some comorbidities, as long as you don't have asthma and other things like that, you know, it's not a terrible place to consider. I still use topiramate as first line, and, you know, our first line treatment is still starting with either an antidepressant or a blood pressure med or an anti-seizure med like topiramate. It's not a bad place to start.
Okay, I
have more side effects.
Yeah, more side effects.
Yeah. So that's, again, you know, sometimes it doesn't make sense sometimes to start with something that may or may not be tolerated, that may take 3 months to show benefit. Because, again, with all of the older drugs, if you look at the studies, you know, you go, okay, we'll start low, we'll go slow, and we'll build up until we get to an effective dose or you have side effects, versus starting with some of our newer drugs, which is already a therapeutic dose. So it's really kind of, I'm hoping the prices, and this is just my caveat, is I'm hoping the prices of some of these more expensive meds come down so that we can use them first line without jumping through hoops for insurance. Because the American Headache Society has come up with a statement. It's the same for the acute meds. You know, start with what works rather than going through this didn't work and that didn't work and we're going through step care. We should be going through stratified care. We'll
absolutely. See. Absolutely. A question that came in from Catherine was, will migraine headaches improve or worsen during and after menopause?
Yes. The answer is yes to both. Yes, right? Yes. Yeah. Migraines generally, 2/3 of women have improvement with menopause. Some people start getting migraines with menopause. During menopause and perimenopause, migraines get worse. But I'd say generally, kind of, and again, I've been doing this for so long, migraines tend to improve as you get older. They don't, you know, I've seen people start getting migraines at the age of 50 or whatever with menopause, but on the whole, kind of rule of thumb is migraines do improve the older you get. But I remember an older neurologist once saying to me, it's the last hurrah, you know, when you start getting worsening of migraine with perimenopause. So, you know, who gets better with menopause? Women who have predominantly menstrual migraine or migraine associated with a menstrual cycle with fluctuating estrogen levels. And once those estrogen levels stable out, then you have fewer migraines. So that's a very kind of an optimistic way of looking at it. 2/3 of women get better after menopause.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, a controversial topic, a pregnant woman comes in with migraine. Should she take Tylenol if she gets relief with it?
You know what? We still say start Tylenol, you know, take Tylenol. And, you know, I'm not even going into politics, but that was our go-to. That's our recommendation. If you go to any talks about managing migraine during pregnancy, you know, our go-to is, you know, if you don't want to take nothing or Tylenol and Redland, metoclopramide. Metoclopramide, maybe it just hasn't made it into politics yet, but metoclopramide has good data in pregnancy. I've got patients that have taken sumatriptan during pregnancy and been just fine. And there's a good pregnancy registry data that sumatriptan, Glaxo, had a wonderful pregnancy registry on Imitrex. So I always kind of pull up the pregnancy registry data and show that, you know, on the whole, I mean, you know, again, the triptans have been around since the 90s. I just don't think they've been targeted yet. I think there's any drug has a problem if you really look for something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tanya, thank you. Thank you for your time today. But more importantly, thank you for always being a resource for our listeners over the course of the past 16 years. We've always enjoyed you coming on the program. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you again. This was lovely.
We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our studio producer today. Kevin Corza has been on the board, and Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we're going to have Dr. Mark Eisen on our show. Dr. Eisen is a specialist in dizziness, and I know we've had many questions about that. And next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Apropos, later on today, I always like to tell people where I'm going to be. I'm going to be at a demonstration today. It is no King's Day. I'm not being paid to be there. I am not a member of a political party, but I am certainly against fascism. And I vote. And I find that apropos to medicine, your ability to vote, your ability to demonstrate are your rights. And rights are like muscles. If you don't exercise them, they atrophy and go away. So if so inclined, get out there and march. And if you see me out there, come on over and say hello. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.